To convict a defendant of communicating threats, the state must prove, among other things, that the person threatened believed the threat would be carried out. In a case where the defendant threatened to kill two police officers, the Court of Appeals has now held the evidence was insufficient to prove communicating threats when there was no evidence one of the two officers believed the threat would be carried out. We'll be discussing that case, State v. Matthews, today. I'm Joseph Hyde with the University of North Carolina School of Government.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook with the North Carolina Conference of DAs.
And this is Turning States, a podcast for North Carolina prosecutors and others interested in the criminal justice system in North Carolina. John, before we talk about communicating threats, there's another recent case about the trial judge's authority to regulate jury selection. Tell us about State v. Johnson.
Well, Joe, normally when we talk about these cases, we start by giving a little bit about the facts. I really can't do much of that in this case, State versus Johnson. I can tell you we got it from the Court of Appeals on November 5th of 2025, and it's a case out of Anson County. But as to what was going on here, there's actually a footnote. Footnote one in the opinion just says, the facts underlying defendant's convictions are not relevant to the procedural issues on appeal, so we don't know a whole lot about it. But what we do know is that the defendant was tried on indictments alleging four counts of statutory sex offense with a child, four counts of indecent liberties with a child, four counts of disseminating obscenity to a minor under age 13, and two counts of third-degree sexual exploitation of a minor. And that after that case came on for trial, the jury deliberated for 30 minutes and then returned guilty verdicts on all charges. So the defendant got an active term of 300 to 420 months, a consecutive 300 to 420 months, and gave notice of appeal in open court. After the trial was done, evidently one of the jurors came forward, it sounds like to the defense attorneys, and informed them that during the trial realized that he knew the defendant and talked about how he felt like the defendant was not guilty and that he had tried to explain why to the other jurors, but that no one was listening. And he said the other jurors were talking about how they have kids and they wouldn't want what happened in this case to happen to their kids. And this juror said that they would have gotten mad at him if he had voted not guilty. And so ultimately, he just went along with the guilty verdict. The defense counsel filed an MAR on that issue. The trial court denied that. They're now addressing these other issues on appeal. And his first argument that he's raising on appeal, we'll come back to that MAR in a minute, but the issues he's raising on appeal about the jury selection that happened in the case, and he's saying that his rights were violated because the judge refused to allow either individual or small group voir dire of the prospective jurors. And then secondly, because the defense wanted to submit a juror questionnaire and have the jurors fill that out in advance, and the trial judge declined that as well. So talking about those two things that he was asking for, first, the defense back at the trial was arguing that since this was a child sex abuse case and a child pornography case, the defense believed that individual or small group voir dire on these, quote, sensitive topics relating to child pornography and sexual acts involving minors was necessary so as not to taint the entire potential juror population. On that issue, the Court of Appeals first explains that the trial judge does have discretion to do smaller group or even individual voir dire of the jurors. And, you know, Joe, when you and I were talking about this case as an example, the one that sort of comes to mind is, let's say we're all concerned about pretrial publicity or something, right? You know, that it's a high profile murder case. If we have one person up there in the box, hey, what do you know about this case? And he says, well, actually, I have a friend who works on the police force. And so I already know X, Y, and Z about the case. Well, now so does every other potential juror sitting in the courtroom. There could be circumstances where it makes sense that we want to do this in groups of 10 or individually bringing them down. And so that's what the defense was asking for the judge to do here. Although even that request was not so explicit. The defense attorney was first talking about this questionnaire that he wanted to have done, 20, 30, 40 questions that would be asked in advance, but then did also talk about in, quote, maybe even individual or small group voir dire would be appropriate in this instance so as not to taint the entire potential population. But the trial judge here, exercising discretion, weighing out the circumstances, concluded that that was not necessary. He said, I'm denying your request for individual voir dire, just didn't think it was needed for this particular case. And the judge's view, yes, these are sensitive topics and they need to be handled carefully, but in the judge's discretion, did not see a reason why that had to be done individually as opposed in front of a group. Didn't think that it would, that the defense counsel could still inquire about all these topics. They just didn't have to be done individually. And so the Court of Appeals says, we're deferring to the judge's discretion on that. We don't see an abuse of discretion here. It could have been allowed. It could have been denied. The judge was within their rights to deny it in this case. The second part was about this.
Well, John, let me ask you, some of those questions on the questionnaire were a little surprising, right? I mean, maybe not surprising that the prosecutor, I don't know if there was any resistance here from the other side, but some of those specific questions that defense counsel wanted to ask the jury, I was a little shocked by.
Absolutely. So, I mean, you know, because again, there are these two issues, right? There's this question of, can we do this individually or in small groups? And then to be clear, there was a second issue that the defense attorney is asking to do a questionnaire, essentially in advance, you know, that I want these prospective jurors to answer 20, 30, 40 questions ahead of time for the purpose of maybe weeding some folks out that we can all agree they're going to have to be excused for cause or what have you. But Joe, you're exactly right. The proposed questions, it wasn't even completed at the time the defense attorney was asking for it. But some of the proposed questions, yes, I agree. I think the state definitely took issue with them. This is not all of them, but some of these questions were things like, have you ever been paid to perform sexual acts or favors? Have you ever engaged in sexual acts with an adult while you were underage? Have you ever watched child pornography? Have you ever been accused of performing a sexual act on a child? If so, when? And so I think the state was definitely taking issue with that of saying, Judge, you know, the defense is asking people to commit in writing to whether or not they are guilty of a criminal act in some of these. And that more broadly, these are not questions, many of them, things that would be appropriate to inquire about in person in jury voir dire, some of these questions. And I think the judge viewed it the same way. And again, to be clear, we can do jury questionnaires. The judge has the discretion to allow that, just like the judge has the discretion to deny it. And in a case with publicity or maybe in homicide cases with a large veneer, maybe those are circumstances where we would want to do that. But the trial court, quote, agreed with the state that several of these questions are just not appropriate in terms of what it would allow in voir dire. And furthermore, it was clear that these are not questions of a general type nature to allow one to receive quickly the sorts of general information that one typically wants to receive. In other words, a questionnaire that says, do you know the defendant? Do you work for law enforcement? Some of those basic questions might speed things along, but that was not this. To the extent that the defense was quoting in their appellate brief cases where it has been allowed, all that does is illustrate how this is a discretionary call the judge can make. We may allow it, we may deny it. That's going to be up to the judge. And the judge was within fair exercise of discretion to say, I don't think it's necessary in this case. We're not going to do it. So it was denied on those two grounds. The final issue before the Court of Appeals is dealing with this juror who came forward and this MAR that was denied at the trial level, you know, essentially asking for a new trial because of arguably issues with how the jury deliberations were conducted. That MAR was denied by the trial court. The defendant failed to appeal from that MAR denial, so is now filing a petition for a writ of cert asking the appellate court to review the denial of the MAR and grant some relief on that. The Court of Appeals ultimately concludes that they say they're declining to grant the petition for writ of certiorari, that this is just not something that needs to be addressed. But sort of in their reasoning for why they're doing that, they're saying that they do not view this as one of those cases where there's a showing merit or extraordinary circumstances that would justify issuing the writ. So in a sense, Joe, they're kind of addressing the merits, even though really it's a question of will we grant it to begin with. But part of the reason they're saying we're not even going to grant the petition is because what the defense would be arguing about here is really not a valid argument anyway. You know, we've got Rule 606C, 606B that forbids jurors from impeaching their own verdict by providing evidence of what happened in the jury room during deliberations. We've also got some statutes and case law on that, 15A, 1240, State versus Corbett. In other words, if a juror feels like, I don't feel good about the way the conversation went, or I don't think my fellow jurors were listening to me as much as I wanted them to, you know, that's just part of the jury process. We're not going to pry the jury room door open and second guess the work that they did. Maybe it would be different if we had evidence of extraneous information that was influencing them, or one of the jurors was blackmailed. You know, then there are these circumstances where we might dig into it. But these kinds of things being raised, they felt like that's clearly within Rule 606, that's not the kind of thing we pry the door open for. And so they declined to grant the petition for writ of cert, in essence, rejecting the legal argument behind it.
Yeah, I feel like it's pretty consistent. That's one of those issues that doesn't come up all that often, but when it does, there's some deep case law on that, that typically a question into the propriety of jury deliberations, as you said, short of juror misconduct or some kind of bribery or intimidation, the courts are not going to kind of crack that door open and get into the mechanics of who did what to whom, so long as you got an ultimate verdict that everybody agreed to in open court.
That's right. Joel, you can poll the jury. I mean, was this your verdict? Is it your verdict still? Are you sure? And so, you know, these kind of things that were being expressed, maybe a little sense of remorse perhaps on this one juror's part about thinking back on it now, I should have held my ground more firmly to my not guilty. That's part of the jury process. I mean, if the other 11 were able to persuade you that you should vote guilty, then leave that black box sealed unless there's compelling evidence that something interfered with the process. And these kind of human dynamics didn't rise to that level. So then, Joe, the next one we had up, what's that? State versus Vaughn.
State v. Vaughn. This was a case decided by the Court of Appeals on November 19th of 2025. This is a case out of New Hanover County. Back on November 28th of 2022, defendant who had a prior felony conviction from 2002, went into a pawn shop and made an initial payment toward the purchase of a shotgun. In January of 2023, defendant returned to the pawn shop, completed a federal questionnaire asking about prior felony convictions. Defendant indicated on that questionnaire, when asked about prior felony convictions, he said no. Defendant's application was subsequently denied. Defendant was charged with possession of a firearm by a felon and providing false information to a dealer. In April 2024, the matter came on for trial by jury. Defendant testified at trial that he believed his prior felony conviction had been expunged. During the charge conference, defendant requested instructions that attempt is a specific intent crime. The trial court did not instruct on the elements of attempt. Defendant then objected to that omission from the instructions. Defendant was convicted by a jury of attempted possession of a firearm by a felon and providing false information to a dealer, and then appealed to the Court of Appeals. Before the Court of Appeals, defendant argued three things. One, that the trial court erred by denying his motions to dismiss based on the sufficiency of the evidence. Two, that the trial court erred in its instructions on possession of a firearm by a felon. And three, that North Carolina's possession of a firearm by a felon statute is unconstitutional. With regard to the sufficiency of the evidence, defendant argued that the evidence was insufficient to show that he provided false information or attempted to possess a firearm by a felon. The Court of Appeals, without reciting the elements of those offenses, concluded that there was ample evidence to show that defendant provided false information to a firearms dealer and attempted to possess the firearm. It noted the defendant's testimony that he believed his conviction was expunged. It noted that the state did not rebut defendant's testimony or present direct evidence of defendant's knowledge. But given that the Court of Appeals was required to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the state and give the state the benefit of all reasonable inferences, it found that the evidence was sufficient at least to submit those charges to the jury. It then went on to address the propriety of those instructions. Defendant argued that the trial court erred when it failed to instruct the jury that attempt requires a finding that, one, the defendant intended to possess a firearm knowing he was a felon, and two, committed an overt act toward possession. To convict for attempt, the Court of Appeals said, the state must prove that the defendant had the intent to commit the substantive offense and that he completed an overt act going beyond mere preparation. Here, the trial court erred by failing to instruct the jury on the elements of attempt. It said, quote, the specific intent required, whether the defendant knew of his prior felony, was not accurately instructed and was a factual question of credibility necessary for the jury to determine. And then turning to the question of whether that error was prejudicial, the Court of Appeals said that the prosecutor made, quote, a clear and egregious misstatement of law when he told the jury that they could believe the defendant's testimony and still convict him of providing false information. Combining the error in the attempt instruction with this alleged misstatement of law in the prosecutor's argument, the Court of Appeals concluded that the error in the instruction was prejudicial given the prosecutor's misstatement and awarded the defendant a new trial on that. That last issue about the constitutionality of the possession of a firearm by a felon statute, General Statute 14-415.1, the defendant asked the Court of Appeals to invoke Rule 2 to address the constitutionality of that statute. Rule 2, remember, is the rule that allows the Court of Appeals to reach out and address issues that were not properly preserved below. The Court of Appeals discussed that, but ultimately declined to address the unpreserved argument regarding the constitutionality of possession of a firearm by a felon. Still, though, it said that the defendant was entitled to a new trial on the conviction for attempted possession of a firearm by a felon based on the error in the instruction on attempt.
So, I mean, Joe, obviously for the prosecutors, if we want to submit to the jury the idea that this was, if nothing else, this was an attempted possession of a firearm by a felon, then yes, let's make sure the jury is instructed on the attempted possession of a firearm by a felon. But I don't see an indication in here that if the jury were properly instructed, that we would not have sufficient evidence to get that conviction, right? I mean, that it, doesn't it seem like, assuming they were properly instructed, we do have some evidence of specific intent and we do have some evidence of an overt act that he was trying to go get it. And then it's just up to the jury to decide if they believe him or not about whether I thought it was expunged.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think you can get there based on the analysis that the Court of Appeals did of the sufficiency of the evidence, because they did find the evidence was sufficient to satisfy the state's burden of at least getting that issue before the jury. So, yes, the fact that the defendant apparently never had this shotgun in his hand was not fatal to this showing that he made an attempt with all the intent that that requires to obtain a firearm by putting a down payment on this on the shotgun at the pawn shop. But yeah, that's correct. Based on the Court of Appeals' conclusion of the sufficiency of the evidence challenge, I think there's no indication here that this evidence would not have been sufficient given a proper instruction. And maybe that's what the state has an opportunity to do on remand here, because the remedy was to give the defendant a new trial on that conviction.
And yet evidently the trial jury was not sufficiently convinced that the, for example, handling it in the store or something might have been sufficient evidence to show actual possession of it prior to him attempting to purchase it. Apparently not for that jury, right? They found him not guilty on that element.
Yeah, I think that's right. And then the last case we had on today was State v. Matthews.
So this was a case from the Court of Appeals out of Moore County originally. It was decided by the Court of Appeals on November 19th. The incident happened back in June of 2020. Officers saw the defendant operating his vehicle. They had information that he was not a currently licensed driver. They saw him parked at a gas station, and while they were observing him, saw what looked like some kind of a drug transaction. A known drug user leans in. There's a brief interaction, and then that person drives away. When the defendant also drives away, the officers follow, verify that he's got a suspended license, and so they're initiating a traffic stop. When the defendant eventually pulls over, the officers exit their patrol vehicle and they approach the defendant. He is belligerent. They order him a couple of times to get out of the vehicle, and he's not complying with that. Then eventually does get out and steps towards the patrol car. When they're telling him to do that, he's responding by screaming at them, F you, on the third order, still refusing to comply. Finally, on the fourth order, exiting the vehicle, but walking away from them. So at that point, they try to place him under arrest, and he's resisting, flailing around, elbowing one of the officers, screaming and cursing. And then significant for this opinion is threatening to kill them and their families. The officers eventually find some relevant evidence that leads to a number of drug and firearm charges. The defendant at trial is facing charges for possession with intent to sell or deliver methamphetamine, possession of methamphetamine, injury to personal property, carrying a concealed weapon, possession of an open container of alcohol in the car, two counts of communicating threats, two counts of resisting a public officer. Some of those are dismissed as the trial goes on, but ultimately a jury does return verdicts, finding him guilty to several different charges involving the possession of drugs, concealed guns, resisting officers, and communicating threats. And he gets a couple sentences of 120 days plus a suspended sentence following that, and ultimately gives notice of appeal. So the issue here that is being addressed by the Court of Appeals is saying that the trial court erred when it denied his motion back at trial to dismiss the charge of communicating threats as to one of the officers, Detective Ballard, because there was no evidence that she believed the defendant's alleged threats. And on that issue, the Court of Appeals says, we agree that conviction needs to be reversed. The offense of communicating threats, just a reminder, there's four elements to it, right? The defendant is willfully threatening to physically injure the person or their child, sibling, spouse, etc. The threat is communicated to the other person orally, in writing, or by other means. Three, that the threat is said in a manner and under circumstances that would cause a reasonable person to believe the threat is likely to be carried out. And number four, that the person threatened believes that the threat will be carried out. And there was evidence of that as to the communicating threats charge for the other officer who was testifying. That was Officer Haddock. We have testimony that's summarized here in the opinion about what he said happened during the arrest. That officer, Haddock, said that the defendant threatened both of the officers officers declaring, "I'm going to kill you and your family." And when asked at trial if he believed that threat, that officer said, "Absolutely," and then gave further testimony about how while under arrest and inside the patrol vehicle, the defendant stated, quote, "I know where you live," and proceeded to accurately describe the house where that officer had previously resided and where this other officer, Detective Ballard, was now currently residing, and then went on to use some insults and slurs against the detective and told her that he was going to kill her whole family. So these are very serious threats. And the first officer, Haddock, is clearly testifying, "Did you believe that was going to happen?" He says, "Absolutely." But the issue is we just don't have anything in the record about did the detective, Ballard, similarly believe that threat would be believable. Just from what I've read out, Joe, you and I could sit here and say, under the third prong, like, would it be reasonable to believe that threat when the person has just literally described the house that you live in? Yes, I think we could easily get to element three, but we need something on element four that this detective did actually believe that.
Jonathan, is the takeaway that for communicating threats, you have to have the testimony of the victim? Do you think that's the...
I mean, certainly that would be the norm. But let's say Detective Ballard is unavailable. I think we would just need to have something to show that the victim did believe it. And I take your point, Joe. It's going to be hard to offer other evidence that gets inside the head of the actual victim. But I mean, even here, I mean, maybe we could have asked Officer Haddock, well, I'm not what did Detective Ballard think? I mean, he doesn't know that. But we could ask, when that threat was made, did you see her have a reaction? Tell me about the reaction. And if his testimony is, I've never seen anyone who looked more terrified in their entire life. I mean, at least then there would be something we could point to say, I think you've got evidence that she did believe that threat. I mean, in fact, that's, you know, whatever it was. If she's not here because... I don't know, because she quit the police force after that. I mean, you know, whatever it is, I mean, there's things we could point to. I don't know that that's true here, but, you know, whatever we've got that could indicate that. But usually it's going to be from the victim. And the other thing I wanted to point out, we've talked a lot in recent cases about true threats, coming back to that State versus Taylor that, you know,
I was wondering about the First Amendment angle here. There wasn't a challenge to this guy's First Amendment rights to threaten the officers, right?
No. And these two concepts, I think they sort of dovetail and intersect in these cases. I mean, for us to show that a person was communicating a threat under that first prong, for example, where it said he willfully threatened the person or their family member, I think under element number one, then we would need to think about State v. Taylor and true threats. Okay, he willfully threatened. What is a true threat? Well, that means, per Taylor, it's an objectively threatening statement with a subjective intent to threaten. And that would be the same framework we would use in some other circumstance if it was a totally different crime of threatening a witness or anything else. But for this charge of communicating threats, it's about making a threat. But then there is this other element, number four, about the person actually believed the threat would be carried
out. That's just by statute.
Just by statute. Exactly. That's what this crime is in North Carolina. By statute, it includes this element number four. So I just want people to keep that in mind. We're not saying every threat case necessarily has to be believed. In fact, under the true threats analysis, it is absolutely not required that the person was really going to carry it out or that the victim, but that's just one part of this statutory framework, which does happen to require that the victim believe it. So ultimately, the court here is forced to say that the defendant's threats to these two law enforcement officers were reprehensible. Nevertheless, there was no evidence, direct or circumstantial, presented at trial evidencing Detective Ballard's belief that the defendant would carry out his threat. Accordingly, the trial court erred by denying the motion to dismiss as to this charge. There is another issue that comes up. The defendant is arguing that the trial court erred by giving a pattern jury instruction 105.21 regarding alleged false, contradictory, or conflicting statements of the defendant. And where this comes from is the defendant did testify, and he talked a little bit about how there was a female in the car, that that person had knocked out a container that the drugs were in when they get out of the car, that he was just getting out to put it back in. And then on cross-examination, there's, I guess I'll just say maybe some confusion or some disagreement about whether he had also said that the gun got knocked out when the female got out of the car, or whether he had only talked about the containers. And so is that contradictory to what he said earlier on direct? And so the defense is arguing that there was no contradiction even here for us to be talking about that would justify the instruction. And so it was error to give it. The Court of Appeals doesn't find that very persuasive. I mean, they point out that in the jury instruction itself, it says, "Ladies and gentlemen, the state contends and the defendant denies that the defendant made false, contradictory, or conflicting statements. So there was something in the record the state could point to that justified giving it, but there's certainly no prejudice here when the instruction itself makes it clear that the defendant disputes that and then ultimately would be up for the jury to decide on their own. So they say that was the jury's call to make. They see the defendant cannot show any prejudice from giving this instruction, and so they would find no error on it. But they do remand it back, saying that we're vacating the conviction for the one communicating threats, and then based on the way the sentences were structured, we're going to have to do a resentencing since there would only be the one communicating threats for the first officer. So an interesting case that no matter how threatening the language might be, statutorily, we still got to hit those four elements on something like communicating threats and then keep that in mind as a separate discussion from what we're doing on the true threats analysis under the First Amendment and Supreme Court precedent.
Right. Well, that's all the time we've got for today. In this episode, we discuss State v. Johnson, finding no error in the trial court's denial of the defendant's request for individual voir dire. State v. Vaughn, granting a new trial when the trial court erred by failing to instruct the jury on the elements of attempt. And State v. Matthews, finding insufficient evidence of communicating threats as to a victim when there was insufficient evidence that the victim believed the threat would be carried out. Turning States is a collaboration between the University of North Carolina School of Government and the North Carolina Conference of District Attorneys. We are coming to you from the recording studio at the School of Government in beautiful Chapel Hill. Special thanks to our producer, Paul Bonner, and to Gustav Holtz for our music. If you liked what you heard today, if you have questions, comments, or concerns, please contact us. My name is Joseph Hyde, and I can be reached at jhyde@sog.unc.edu.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook. I can be reached at jonathan.p.holbrook@nccourts.org.
Thank you, John. That would be the showing for the state.
Sounds good, Joe. Thanks. Hope it helped.